Coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borgfung Earthlets, and welcome to another episode of the 2000 AD Thrillcast. I am Molchar, your host for the official 2000 AD podcast. We've got a couple of special guests this week. We have award-winning author Lauren Bucas and Joey Hi-Fi, otherwise known as Dale Halverson, who is a cover designer and artist. They're going to be talking a little bit about their experience with 2000 AD, how it's influenced their careers, and what it's like growing up in a small town in South Africa when your only comic really is 2000 AD. So it's going to be an absolutely fascinating chat with them in a little bit. But first, let's talk about what we've got coming out from 2000 AD this week. First off, what is the secret of Prog 1977? Yes, we're finally at the issue number that corresponds with the year of 2000 AD's first publication. And we've got a nice little story in there. Tharg the Mighty himself makes a rare appearance in a comic book strip in 2000 AD. We are obviously counting down to Prog 2000, which comes around later in the year, of which there will be more details in a future episode of the 2000 AD Thrillcast. So Prog 1977 is out now from all good stockists, as well as digitally from our web shop and apps. We also have Judge Dredd Magazine 371, which, I'm not going to give too much away on this one, but you need to be reading the Judge Dredd stories at the moment. Grindstone Cowboys in 2000 AD, and the strip that's just beginning in Judge Dredd Magazine. It is a crossover between the two, but not like any you've read before. This is a really fascinating experiment by Michael Carroll, who will be switching the story between the two publications as it goes along, and there's some quite big things happening. Make sure you pick up a copy of both, again, from Stockis or our web shop and apps. Plus, if you go onto our web shop, you can put in a pre-order for a couple of new collections which are coming out soon. Case Files number 27, Judge Dredd Collection, The Law in Order. We're getting up to the really, really good stuff now. Case Files 27 is out in a month or so's time, and that is absolutely packed with some great work, all written by John Wagner. This is, I think, the first collection that's all written by John Wagner. So it's certainly one for your shelves. And also you can pre-order Monster, which is the Alan Moore, John Wagner and Alan Grant written series from Scream magazine. Something a little bit different to our 2000 AD stuff, but it's well worth picking up some classic black and white artwork from the absolute heyday of British comics. Also, make sure that you are signed up to the 2000 AD Thrillmail. This is a weekly email newsletter that goes out into your inboxes with competitions, with news, with free comics. And when you sign up, you get 460 pages of free comics sent to you, which is, quite something. So make sure you go to www.2000adonline.com/thrillmail. That's all one word, /thrillmail. Lauren Bucas is an award-winning novelist, also comic book writer, and as she self-describes, recovering journalist, who's the author of books such as Broken Monsters, The Shining Girls, Zoo City, and Moxieland. She's also in the process of writing the horror comic Survivors Club. She's a big 2000 AD fan. If any of you watched the Future Shock documentary about the history of 2000 AD, she is one of the faces in there. And Joey Hi-Fi, otherwise known as Dale Halverson, is a book cover designer and co-writer of Survivors Club with Lauren. Fantastic artist, also a big 2000 AD fan, and it's an absolute pleasure to welcome them to talk about 2000 AD on the 2000 AD podcast. Welcome to the Thrillcast, guys.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So let's talk about 2000 AD. That's the reason we're here. Start off with you, Lauren. Tell me a little bit about how you got into 2000 AD, because most people, I think, would assume that 2000 AD kind of in the past has always followed the British diaspora. So You know, we have fans in Australia, we have fans in America, we have fans in New Zealand. South Africa, though, that's one that doesn't often crop up on the radar. How did you come into contact with 2080 originally?
It was one of the only comics I could get hold of regularly.
Oh, really? Wow.
We had, because of apartheid, we had sanctions against us.
Right.
And also, no one really, rightfully so, I should say. And no one really bought comics. You would get one issue of DC's Amethyst, and then 3 months later, you might get, you know, an issue like five along. So yeah, it was impossible to keep track of anything. But 2000 AD monthly came in regularly, and I had my local news agent keep it for me. They set it aside, and my mom would go in and get her magazines, and I would get my 2000 AD.
Wow. I mean, that's interesting in of itself, that with all these sanctions, it was comic books from Britain that made its way through.
Yep.
And when you started reading it, what was the effect on? I mean, how old were you when you started reading it?
I'm gonna have to do maths now. That's a horrible thing to do. I think
must have been about 14.
Yeah,
13, 14, 12.
But I started in like 88.
Oh,
so
okay, so yeah,
89. So yeah, about 13.
Okay. So 89. That was what around about the time in Necropolis and things like that.
Yeah.
And what was the effect on your 13-year-old mind?
I loved the stories. I loved the depth and the strangeness, and the fact that there were a lot of like cool female characters. They actually existed, which was amazing.
Mm.
And you know, I'd read Bunty before that, and there was a great horror girls comic called Misty, which my dad actually threw away because he thought it was satanic. It's a good thing he never actually looked at my nemesis, the Warlock. But yeah, it was just these amazing, mind-blowing, strange stories, which also folded in social issues in a really interesting way. And I often say that 2000 AD was one of the major influences on how I write and what I write about.
Okay, I mean, we'll come on to the influence on of 2000 AD on your career in a bit, Dale. Just before we started chatting on the record, as it were, you mentioned that you and Lauren had been comparing the levels of your collections, how many issues you've got, but you came off worse in this, didn't you?
Oh yes, I did by a long way. Even when I padded my pile with annuals, I still didn't have enough.
And what is the cause of this?
My mother, my mom throwing away all my 2080s. I would have won if it wasn't for that fact. When I left home, I left them in boxes in the garage and some in my room, and I never used to visit home quite that often, so 6 months would go by a year, and they were there 6 months before. And then when I came to visit again, I was like, where are all my boxes of comic books? And my mom was like, oh, those old things, I threw them out. Didn't even give them to anyone. She just tossed them in the trash. So there went my entire 2080 collection. But I actually, every time I went to visit home, I would rummage through the garage and rescue a few copies and take them back on the plane with me. So those are the ones that landed up in my pile that I ended up comparing with Lauren. Not enough.
Because you grew up in a small town in the south coast of Natal.
Yes.
I mean, that's an odd place, even in the context of what we've just talked to Lauren about. That's still a relatively odd place for 2080 to rock up, wasn't it?
Yeah, I grew up on the Natal South Coast, which I call Twin Peaks by the Sea. So that'll paint you a little bit of a picture. But when I moved there, we didn't even have a news agent. So not as fancy as you, Lauren.
Yeah, Joburg, man. Joburg girl.
But we did have corner stores, and they had just the strangest patchwork of comic book titles. But what they did have is a lot of 2080s for some reason. I don't know where they came from or how they got there. So I used to get my parents to drop me off at the corner store, and used to spend the whole day just looking through all these comic books and coming back with my hands covered just black from like all the dust on them. Because there were no restrooms around, so there's no place for me to wash my hands. Mm. So yeah, I mean, that was my first encounter with 2000 AD.
Now I need to know, where did you pee?
Teenage boy, you just, yeah.
Okay, fine. Let's not go there.
Yeah.
And anywhere he wanted to is probably the answer to that, yeah. Joey, let's talk about your favourites when you first started reading. Because was this around the same time that Lauren had started reading?
I think I was in primary school. So when was it? It was late 80s. Mm. So yeah, I think it was probably around about 10, 11 that I discovered my first 2000 AD comic.
Okay.
You would have been 12. We're the same 12. Age. Yeah. You would have been 12, 13.
Maths.
Yeah, maths.
words, yes, maths. what I loved was that the issues that we did have were like the best ofs.
Oh, there was a lot of those.
So you were exposed to all the 2000 AD characters. So I think like my favorite initially was Judge Dredd. I really loved Ron Smith's like drawing style. Mm. Second to that, probably ABC Warriors, robots. Those were my two favorite.
It's interesting that the 2000 AD, the best of 2000 AD monthly. I mean, that was my gateway drug into 2000 AD before I started reading the progs regularly. It was an extraordinary education because you got all the classics, all the black and white classics, straight, you know, in essentially graphic novels just off the newsstand. It was a hell of a thing for them to be putting out there at the time.
Yeah, it was amazing.
And Lauren, what were your key sort of memories of that early 2000 AD phase? What were the things that really kind of stand out for you?
Well, The Ballad of Palo Jones is, I think, one of my favorite books of all time. Just remarkable. I loved, you know, Judge Anderson versus Judge Death. The more nuanced stories, Bad Company was just incredible, like so strange and bizarre and wonderful and twisty and great social conscience. Johnny Alpha obviously resonated very much because we're talking about mutant segregation, and that felt like a really interesting way of also looking at South African politics at the time. Mm.
Let's talk about that a little bit because it was a kind of looking back on it now, it seems almost surreal that there was a country so utterly divided by law, by politics, by race, by everything, and that something as subversive as 2000 AD was able to get through and give you a different perspective on things.
I think the censors weren't paying attention, and our censors were insane. I mean, they censored the book Black Beauty about the horse because it had the words Black Beauty in the title. They were completely demented. But then weird stuff slipped through. And that my favorite story of the apartheid era, censorship era, was the TV series V about the aliens that ripped off their faces and there were lizards underneath. Mm-hmm. And our then state president, P.W. Botha, phoned the head of the South African Broadcasting Corporation and said, "You must take the show off air immediately." And he said, "Well, I'm not going to take it off air, but I'll push it to a later time slot." And I was so upset at the time because I loved that show. And I said to my mom, I'm like, "What's going on? Why has it been moved?" And she said, "Well, you know, the problem is that it uses the word freedom fighters and the government doesn't like that." But the story was so bizarre. I was like, this can't be true. And a couple of years ago, I started asking a journalist friend of mine, and he was like, no, it was much worse than that. Because P.W. Botha's nickname was the Big Crocodile, Die Groot Krokodil.
Yeah.
And he was so vain, he thought the Americans had made the show about him.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's why I wanted to take it off air.
So what you said, P.W. Botha was a space lizard.
Well, obviously. On all world leaders.
Makes a lot of sense, actually.
David Icke was right, man. David Icke was right. But yeah, it was just hilarious. But like, yeah, so I'm amazed it snuck through. But it was interesting because there was a lot of subversive material, but it was all told in allegory. So in Afrikaans class, we studied a lot of really interesting Afrikaans literature, which there was a book, for example, about the Irish Revolution. And it was secretly, it was a sneaky way of writing about the South African Revolution and what was happening here. So 2000 AD fits absolutely beautifully with that, of using allegory, of using kind of crazy science fiction, you know, just these mental stories about a dystopian state and a totalitarian police regime. It really resonated.
You mentioned Halo Jones then. You did the introduction to the new edition of Halo that we did a couple of years ago. And in that you refer to Halo as your first love. Do you wanna elaborate a bit more on that?
Yeah, I can't really find anyone who lives up to her. Because she had this incredible passion and ambition, and she wanted more. And she wanted to get out, and she wanted to get out of her circumstances. And I think also being in South Africa, where we were so isolated, we're still isolated now, just in terms of distance to anywhere else in the world. But it felt like something which really rang true for me. That was something that I wanted to do, was get out and like go and explore the world and see different things. And the stuff that she got involved with, the adventures she had, the politics she fell into by accident, and the way she came through it in her personal journey was just so beautifully plotted. It was fantastic. And I kind of wanted a robot dog to be in love with me too.
it's a remarkable, even when you just scratch slightly below the surface, a remarkable clarion call for anybody who's disaffected and feels isolated by society and doesn't feel that where they are is the place that they need to be.
Absolutely. And I think it's actually one of Alan Moore's more hopeful books. Mm. It kind of has a happy ending.
Book three is kind of like the horrors of war, basically. Yeah.
Yeah. But she comes out of it. She comes through.
Yeah.
Well, I always thought one of the things with Halo was just how non-straightforward her story is. That there's, you know, she takes one step forward, two steps back, three steps forward, one step back. So there's never a kind of sense that there's any of that bullcrap destiny stuff. You know, she's just living her life as she finds it.
Yep, and muddling through and doing the best that she can. Hmm. And yeah, I think that's telling for a lot of 2080 stories, was that you couldn't predict where they were going to go. They weren't play by numbers. And that was always really exciting about those stories, that I was like, I don't know what's going to happen next, and I have to get the next book in this series, or I'm going to die. And that's also why I could never handle the weekly progs, because I'm very impatient and I needed the whole story. I needed to be able to devour it and then reread it. And I must have, you know, my 2080s are falling apart because I've reread them so many times.
Dale, what about you? I mean, was Halo a highlight for you, or was there another story that really kind of opened your eyes to a different perspective?
Well, I also really loved the Halo Jones. There were so many. For me, it was also the art. Mm. It had a huge impact on me, and it's still, you see it in my work. Like, I just loved like the stark black and white whiteness of the issues, and yeah, I've never been able to kind of get past that. There was just something really cool about it. And so the range of styles, just from the art style, I had a few friends who also shared my love of 2080, and we were like, this would be amazing if one day we could work for 2080. So we used to spend hours copying the drawings. Like, what about this? What about that? So that's from an art perspective. It had a huge impact on me. From a storytelling perspective, I was always really attracted to the Judge Dredd stories, particularly the Dark Judges. Mm. I'm big into horror, so anything with kind of a horror slant kind of automatically sucks me in. So Nemesis the Warlock, I was really big into. And what I liked about the Judge Dredd stories was the dystopian aspect of it, and like the from growing up in South Africa and that having an analog for kind of like the country that you're growing up in, there's something about it that really like resonated with me. That the police force, like Judge Dredd, is a force for good, that can be argued, but also this, in many ways, kind of like a fascist kind of character. So it was always an interesting, like, there's a lot of gray area there, which I always thought was compelling, because I felt that a lot of like DC Marvel characters were very black and white. They were either heroes or villains. Mm. And 2000 AD had a lot of characters that were set somewhere in between. So one week they'd be heroic, and then the next week you'd see them do something a little less heroic. It just made them more human, even though a lot of them were aliens.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Nemesis there, because certainly in your work, I see a touch of the John Hicklinton, but also that kind of influx of the slightly more underground, the punky aesthetic with people like Brett Ewins and Jim McCarthy. Are there people that you can sort of directly trace what you do now back to? You know, are there certain images that always sort of jam in your mind, always crop up when you're working?
Simon Bisley's one, weirdly. I kind of grew up really idolizing him, especially his black and white stuff. Mm. I think that he did for Slain.
ABC Warriors Black Hole. He did, yes. Black and white, yeah.
On arts, I definitely Ron Smith. He was a big one. I think those are the two foremost ones that I can think of. But they were all really amazing artists. So I think I borrowed a lot from little bits from each one.
Was it that sitting down and copying the comics that you were reading? Is that what has led to your career? Is there a direct line between those two things? Is it what inspired you to go on to become an artist?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm pretty much self-taught. Even though I studied graphic design, I didn't do illustration. So that's how I learned. And all the friends I have are also illustrators. That's often what we share in common. It's like, there was no way to study illustration in South Africa in the early 90s. So you had to teach yourself these techniques. There was no comic book school. There were no South African comics, really. Mm. So it was just hours and hours of just shamelessly ripping off and copying like other artists' work until you figured out how they did it, and then you'd move on. So I still do that. Like, if I see something I really like, I like to sit down and try and figure out how they did it without someone telling me how they did it. There's something nice about making that discovery yourself. Mm. That's why, like, my style, I have a range of different styles I work in, and I'm a bit of a chameleon in that I've always had the ability to kind of look at someone else's work, and for good or bad, and think to myself, I wonder how they did it, and then try it, and then kind of being able to draw in that style. Mm. That's kind of how I learned.
Because 2000 AD itself is a hell of a chameleon over the last four decades, with so many different art styles. I mean, when I first started reading, it blew my mind that you know, you'd have fully painted Simon Bisley stuff next to black and white, next to, you know, your traditional line arts, next to somebody like Carlos Esquerra. It there was no house style at all, was there?
No. I mean, that's, like I said earlier, that's what really, just from the storytelling aspect, also from the art aspect, you're just exposed to these range of styles, which you don't get to see in DC or Marvel comics or any other comics, actually. So especially as a tween or a teenager, that stuff is mind blowing, mm-hmm. really. I mean, also exposes you to so many different ways of doing things. I think it just opens your mind to like the possibilities of, you can tell a story this way, you can draw a story, that you can illustrate a story this way. There's no like real set template, for like a rigid template like they tend to be in like some other comic books.
Mm-hmm. What I loved about the black and white art was just amazing, and it was so beautiful. And I remember the first comic I wrote, the black and white art was phenomenal. And then they colored it. And the colorist is brilliant, but I still kind of prefer the black and white. And I think that's deep 2000 AD, you know, training. Conditioning. Deep 2000 AD conditioning. Which is funny because my 7-year-old daughter refuses to read anything in black and white. I'm having to buy Scott Pilgrim in color. I had to buy Bone in color. She won't read it in black and white. It's really annoying.
You know what? That's something that crops up an awful lot at comic book conventions is, you know, people come to our store, they don't know our stuff, they start flicking through, and they will say, "Oh, this looks great. Does it come in colour?"
Mm-hmm.
And we're like, you're holding a copy of Judge Dredd, Case Files number 5, Halo Jones, Bad Company, you know. Take it as it is and appreciate its genius or put it away and go away. but Lauren, we've talked a little bit about the kind of subversive political side of 2000 AD. Can you draw a line between reading 2000 AD and becoming a writer? Is there a direct causal link between those two things?
Absolutely, definitely. And the character in my book, Toby in Moxieland, is named for Toby in, you know, the robot dog in Halo Jones. But yeah, it was actually that. It was using these crazy science fiction stories as a way of exploring who we are in the world right now, and also to be able to deal with moral complexities, and to dig deep into what that meant and what that does to us, and to not have straightforward good guys and bad guys. It was really important. Between South African theatre, which did that very well, there was some incredible theatre in like the 80s and 90s, which were very subversive, which used fantastical stories as a way of exploring the current political climate. And 2000 AD, that absolutely shaped me as a writer and who I am and what I write about.
And with books like Zoo City and The Shining Girls, I don't know whether you reread the work that you've done before. If a 2000 AD reader were to pick these up, would they sort of feel that influence a bit?
I think so. Definitely in Moxieland. I'm not sure. Dale, you might be better. Dale does all these South African covers for me.
Right.
Dale, what do you think? I don't know.
That they'd be able to feel the
2000 AD influence, the DNA.
Well, you often have multiple character POVs.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's there. I think if you didn't know that, it would make a lot of sense. If you were like, oh, she read a lot of 2000 AD. Yeah. It all makes sense. It all comes together.
Well, you could imagine a story like Moxieland playing out.
Oh, definitely.
Like Mega City 1.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It has a very, 2000 AD sci-fi feel to it. It's like, it is under the surface, I think, if you were to look.
Yeah. And also horror, you know, horror in 2000 AD, as you were saying, Dale, about, you know, the Dark Judges and a lot of Anderson's kind of demon stories.
Nemesis the Warlock.
It was really hard to get those. And also my dad freaked out whenever I did. but he didn't look at 2000 AD. It was great. And I think that horror influence is very strong in my work. Yeah.
I mean, you've both mentioned Nemesis the Warlock and certainly... I mean, Kevin O'Neill's stuff, it somehow manages to combine this kind of gothic horror with a deep subversive sense of humor. So it's continually mocking not just, you know, obvious institutions like the Catholic Church, which Pat uses the strip to have a go at, but also just power in of itself. You know, all these structures, all these characters are just so utterly... over the top and horrific with it as well.
Yep. And I also want my own pet T-Rex to wreak vengeance upon my enemies.
Yeah, the first time I saw Nemesis the Warlock in a 2080 comic, but even before reading the story, I was like, this is one of the most unique, weird character designs I've ever seen. Is this the good guy? Is he the bad guy?
Yeah. So freaky.
Yeah, even after reading, being a fan, I'm not quite sure kind of where he stands, because he kind of, again, it's gray areas.
Yeah.
But at the time when I encountered Nemesis the Warlock, I was super religious. I grew up as a Jehovah's Witness. And reading Nemesis the Warlock was a weird experience for me, because the villains were essentially the religious zealots. And I just it made me think about the pitfalls of blind devotion to a cause. all of the subjects of the Torquemada and that was a little interesting bit of like subversive storytelling to me. When I think back, I was like, I wonder if that kind of planted a seed in me to question kind of the faith structure that I'd grown up in.
So do you think it's safe to say that basically, essentially, 2000 AD has made us both all of who we are? Like that it helped you break free of religion. It made you into the illustrator you are today. We're just going to give 2000 AD all the credit here.
Excellent. Yeah. I'm quite happy with that.
I definitely played a large part. Mm. Because that was the comic that I probably read the most growing up.
Yeah.
2018.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know who it was who is bringing it into the country.
I'd love to know.
I would like to find that person and shake their hand.
And how they landed up on the Natal South Coast in these little corners, not even the CNA, like, which came later, but like just in these little corner stores, where do they come from? Mike Carey had an interesting story.
Yeah.
About he also grew up in a small British seaside town. Sorry, Mike, I'm stealing your story.
No, you carry on.
and he, it was a shipping town. So ships used to come in and they used to use comic books as ballast, just piles and piles of comic books as ballast. Then when the ship was leaving, they'd leave those piles and piles of comic books there. And most of them were 2000 AD. I wish that was the case, but he said they were DC comics. And that's how he got exposed to comic books in this, small seaside town. So that was quite interesting. I mean, I wonder, were there ships using 2000 AD?
maybe the apartheid government was using it as a way of like smuggling the nuclear arms into the country. It came packed in 2000 AD.
Or maybe the censors looked at Judge Dredd and was like, this is our kind of guy.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
This is, if we are aiming for like a Mega City 1 type scenario.
Totally. Also, not that many black characters in 2000 AD.
No.
So, you know.
Well, because in the very, very early days, Judge Dredd was originally meant to be black, supposedly.
Really? Mm. Wow.
Yeah. Carlos Esquerra has talked about this in Thrill Power Overload, the history of 2000 AD as well. How he envisaged an America of the future as being much more racially mixed.
Yep.
So, because it's 122 years in the future, you know, you're several generations on, so the races have mixed an awful lot. So Judge Dredd was supposedly meant to be have the characteristics of somebody of mixed race. So that was something, because it was black and white.
You would know.
Later artists didn't necessarily understand that, so they naturally drew him as a white guy. But yeah, it's an odd footnote in the history of Judge Dredd that he was originally not meant to be white.
Now you're making me think of Idris Elba as Judge Dredd instead of Carl Urban.
That would be amazing.
That would be amazing. I would watch the hell out of that. But I think it's very telling that the most recent Judge Dredd movie was actually filmed in South Africa.
Mm.
You know, it's like, yep, that's us all over.
We were just having a discussion earlier about how interesting it would be to set a story in the Judge Dredd universe in South Africa with local judges.
I'm thinking Durban, like kind of, because Durban's got a bit of a Miami feel.
Wouldn't Joburg be a more natural setting?
It would, right? Durban could be interesting. Humidity and like palm trees and sugarcane and
neon, lots
neon,
of neon.
Absolutely.
The Miami of South Africa.
Yeah.
I hate to break it to you. According to one map that was printed in Shambhala in the Judge Anderson story, South Africa didn't come out of the atomic wars very well.
Well, we would then be in the Durban Badlands, where a mutant judge is. I mean, I've never seen the mutant judge story before, but I'm sure we could do something interesting with it.
Like a Fury Road type scenario.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
I always did think it was unfair. Even as a kid, reading Shambhala and looking at that map, I was going, oh, poor South Africa. It's completely, why would somebody do that? That seems an odd thing to do.
A Mega City 1 judge asks to be exiled to the Badlands of South Africa to bring law to the lawless.
Mm-hmm, right. And then get schooled.
and then get schooled.
Yeah, nice.
Sounds like a plan. You guys pitch it, you know, we'll run it. Yeah.
Well, I thought that's what we were doing.
All right. Oh, yeah, sure. Absolutely. I'll send the contracts.
Okay.
Talking about the history of 2000 AD, Lauren, you were featured in the Future Shock documentary that's just gone out. It's interesting that they were able to talk to so many different people, not just from within comics, but outside of comics as well. And the remarkable amount of influence that 2000 AD has had, you know, and as we've been talking about already, people who can directly trace the influence of 2000 AD in their lives. How did you feel about being asked to be a part of the Future Shock documentary, this official history?
It was so cool. I was so excited. You know, it was. I had so much to say. I was like, yes, ask me. I'm so glad you asked me. And then I think I went off for like 2 hours. I probably had to do a lot of editing. But yeah, it was so great, and it was so nice to see such a variation of people who'd all been influenced the same way I had, and it felt like connecting with the tribe. It felt like a religion, really. We should, instead of like, you know, handing out Jehovah's Witnesses, what is that called?
what's it called?
The Watchtower?
Oh, yeah, Watchtower.
Yeah, instead of handing out Watchtowers, we should hand out, you know, 2080s. Go door to door. Hello, have you heard the word of, you know?
Yeah.
Of Thad the Mighty, yeah.
Absolutely.
I think I'd probably be a very different person today. No, I'd probably be the same person, but I probably would have taken thrill power, the power of thrills.
May the power of thrills compelling.
Yeah.
Like it.
And, I mean, we've talked a lot about the kind of classic stuff. Is 2000 AD something that's very much in your past, or is it something that you've sort of picked up more recently?
I think I can speak for myself here that I kind of fell off the 2000 AD wagon.
The thrill wagon.
The thrill wagon. Maybe that's why I have so little thrill in my life.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm going to tell your girlfriend you said that.
Hello! yeah, but when you contacted us, I was like, oh, let me just see. I have touched bases over the years. Mm. And nothing, for some whatever reason.
I don't see them at our local comic stores. Like, yeah, I don't think they carry them now.
They just disappeared for a while. Mm. So it was harder to get hold of. So I think there was a long period where we didn't see anything. And
so we're hopelessly out of touch. And if you have some recommendations for us, that would be awesome.
Absolutely. Many, many recommendations.
But especially if there are best of collections, because I can't do the single issue thing. I'm too impatient.
Well, just in the last sort of 16 years since Rebellion have been the owners of 2000 AD, things like Shikara, things like Leviathan, Nicolai Dante, Kingdom. You probably like Kingdom. It's genetically modified dogs fighting giant insects in a post-apocalyptic future.
I'm sold.
Excellent. Good. As you can tell, I've said that sentence quite a lot in the past. I mean, you know, other people's mileage may vary, but I think certainly in the last sort of 5-10 years, it's as inventive and varied and interesting and entertaining as it's ever been. Sort of looking at how you write characters, Lauren, in the intro to Halo Jones, you talk about the story being about choices and compromises, defying expectations, poverty, society, celebrity, identity, the toll of war, love, ambition, ambivalence, and restless curiosity. What did that mean to you as a young girl living in somewhere, as you said, isolated in South Africa? What did reading characters like that actually mean to you and do to you as a person?
I think it gave me something to aim for. Hmm. It resonated with who I was. You know, I think we always read looking to connect with characters and looking for something of ourselves in them. So it was projecting into that life. It was wanting to step into that, you know, and there've been a couple of stories that I wanted to step into in my life. The first one obviously was Narnia. You know, I would always open my wardrobe and check every morning, and there was never any freaking lamppost or doorway into the snow. It was very disappointing. But Halo Jones was another one of the books I wanted to get inside and live in. Later it would be, you know, stuff like William Gibson's Pattern Recognition. So it was something I read again and again and again, and those aspects of her, the curiosity, the ambition, the refusing to settle for the way things are, even when people try to talk around. I think that really spoke to my own determination.
You've got other female characters like Judge Anderson and Durham Red, which do fit much more into the kind of quote-unquote kick-ass women kind of, you know, strong female characters kind of trope. But did you enjoy them as well? I mean, was this a kind of multifaceted enjoyment of the female characters in 2000 AD?
Definitely. You know, Purity Jones and Nemesis. Zenith had some really interesting female characters.
Anderson was
my other love. You know, I really read for Anderson and Halo Jones. And it was always exciting to come back to them. I wish there had been more, but it was one of the few comics which really allowed you to see really well-rounded, interesting people. And yeah, sure, Durham Red was badass, but there weren't a lot of badass women at that time in comics, and not on those kind of terms. And it was also interesting, you know, that she was very sexy, but also just hardcore. But on her own terms, not, you know, she wasn't just there as pinup material, although I seem to remember there being some kind of pinup covers.
Yeah, they were.
but it was exciting.
Okay. And Dale, what about you? I mean, we've talked about Judge Dredd, we've talked about Nemesis the Warlock. But as a young lad in South Africa with this background, what was the character that kind of spoke to you, that influenced you the most?
Sorry, I just on that note before I let you speak, I think it's also important to remember that we grew up as white South Africans, we grew up in utopia.
Right.
You know, and I think that's what was also interesting was the kind of moral ambiguity we were living with in our own lives was that we were living in this paradise, but it came at a terrible cost to the majority of the people in the country. So, you know, we've been talking a lot about the dystopian themes, but that wasn't something you felt every day on the street. You felt happy suburban riding your bicycle around. You know, we were aware of the politics. My parents were certainly politically, they weren't necessarily activists, but they were involved through their church and with various organizations like Habitat for Humanity. But generally you didn't feel it. White people just got on with their lives. So I think, but there was a dissatisfaction and a dystopia lurking underneath the surface. And I think 2080 gave us a way of exploring that and reflecting it. Dale, I will now let you speak.
Thanks. No, well put, because that was definitely, and it was interesting as well, growing up in that environment, that it was often the children that made those, when you grow up in utopia and then you realize that you aren't living in utopia, that you're essentially, if it was Star Wars, you'd be on the side of the Empire. And then to talk to your parents about that, but there's kind of a deep denial on their side. And not in all cases, but yeah, it was always, you know, a bit of a shock growing up that like what your parents told you and reality are two different things. What the government's telling you and reality are two different things. And that you are actually, you know, you're the villains, you're the noughts, basically. All that, like, you know, Torquemada is running your country. I think that the character that I was initially most attracted to, besides Judge Dredd, was Nemesis the Warlock. I have a huge soft spot for the entire storyline.
Monsters.
Yeah, monsters, aliens, xenophobia, religion, horror. There was a lot of those themes that like really appealed to me, and the art was generally always amazing. I'd probably say Nemesis the Warlock.
Sorry, go on.
No, carry on.
Oh, it, it's fascinating to think of 2080 randomly ends up in these sort of small towns of South Africa, essentially helping act as a prism for you guys to explore things that probably you may not have consciously realized, but you probably latently felt like all children can identify undercurrents. You know, they can identify inconsistencies. They can see when people are acting contrary to how they should. Yeah, it's remarkable that 2000 AD was able to frame this.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But I think, you know, that is also the punk aesthetic of 2000 AD. Mm. It was that subversive aspect and kind of giving the middle finger to authority and things that you knew, but also just telling really great stories, really great stories. It only worked because it was a really great story. If it had just been political agenda, it would have been very tedious.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it was a deeper to all the storytelling. Sure, it was entertaining and it was well-drawn. But there was always an underlying moral lesson that you could get from it, which made you think about your surroundings.
But I think we were also going through some of our issues before we got on the line with you, and stuff like Ace Shipping as well, just super fun, just ridiculous and wonderful, and was it Sam Spade?
Sam Slade, Robo Hunter, yeah.
Yeah, and it was also just ridiculous. It was great.
I think in people's rush to sort of talk about the dark humor of things like Judge Dredd, I think people forget a lot of the funny strips like Ace, like Robo Hunter. You know, the Verdas storyline was the first in Best of 2080 Monthly. It was the first contact I ever had with Robo Hunter. It had me in absolute stitches. I mean, you know, not just the script, but Ian Gibson's cute little droids absolutely bristling with guns.
Yep. Totally. No, it was great. Slane was also just beautiful. Slane was amazing. And again, like really interesting female characters. Although I never managed to collect all the Slanes and I still don't really know what was going on. I don't really know what was going on, but it was amazing. The bits I managed to piece together were just incredible. And the worm god Crom and the witchery, I loved it.
Talking about, yeah.
But I'd like someone to explain to me what was going on.
you and me both.
Okay.
Sometimes I miss that. When did you stop reading? When was the kind of point at which you lost the thread of Slane?
I don't know. I mean, I have a pretty full collection of monthlies from 88 to probably 94, 95.
Okay. Okay.
Which is when I went backpacking overseas, and then that's kind of where I stopped collecting.
Okay. A lot has happened since then.
Okay.
It's lame. But we can bring you up to speed quite easily. Dale, was Slane a strip that you particularly enjoyed?
I share huge gaps of the story are missing for us.
Yeah.
But the artwork always blew me away. I think that was my main draw card to it. Just that world, the fantasy. Because I mean, there's only Conan.
Yeah. Which was crap.
So I grew up always wanting to see these 2080 characters as films, which we've only had, I'm only counting one.
I've got to tell you, we were so culturally starved that I got a lot of my movie education from Mad Magazine and the movie parodies. And that was also one of the only ways I'd get my horror fix. Because, of course, they did movie parodies of stuff like Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And so that was interesting. So that's how I kind of got to understand some horror. Always through comedy.
That's absolutely fascinating that you're kind of absorbing culture through a filter. That's good. One of the things I was going to ask about was particularly in the Future Shock documentary, everyone talks a lot about how British it is, how, you know, it was embodiment of that punk spirit of the late 70s. Did you in South Africa get a sense of 2080 being an expression of a British culture? Because, I mean, if you weren't able to get hold of American comics, I guess there wasn't that much to compare them to.
Well, we had American TV shows.
Right, and okay.
And you would get American comics, but you wouldn't get them with any kind of consistency. So it was impossible to follow the storyline. And that's why the monthlies appealed so much, because you had this whole complete story. Mm. I don't know. I don't know if it felt particularly British. I feel like we were so culturally starved for anything. And, you know, South Africa's, we've always looked up to America and the UK generally. Mm. For our culture. So, but we didn't have, you know, we didn't grow up with stuff like Time Lords.
Doctor Who.
Thank you. God, how embarrassing. we didn't grow up with Doctor Who. We didn't grow up with a lot of that kind of, you know, really interesting TV. We grew up with American TV and British comics. So I don't know if we had any real sense. Also, we were young. We were like, you know, 10 or 12 or whatever the maths was that we worked out. Like, we were born in 76, okay? I don't know what year we saw.
I was born in 77, so your math was wrong.
Well, you're 6 months younger, come on.
I mean, one of the things that came out of the Future documentary was about how, to a certain extent, 2000 AD has remade the comics industry in its own image. Because, you know, you had the British invasion of the 1980s, and then again in the 1990s, and then, you know, even in the 21st century, we're still exporting British artists and writers to the States, and that has had a knock on effect in other realms, you know, not just comics but also movies as well. In terms of sci-fi fiction, do you think? Beyond your writing, Lauren, do you think things like 2000 AD, that you can feel 2000 AD's DNA in how science fiction has evolved over the last sort of few decades?
Well, it's such a broad church, it's hard to say. Mm. You know, I feel like there's elements of that in China Miéville's work, Mike Carey, obviously. Mm. Yeah, you know, I think it's one of those things which does get deep into your DNA, but I wouldn't be able to point to one particular book and say, look, that's clearly.
Also, those writers from 2008 had such a huge impact on the comic book industry as a whole. I mean, you just take someone like Alan Moore.
Yeah.
I mean, he already started 2008.
I think it was actually Warrior, wasn't it?
Warrior.
Yeah. But yeah, absolutely. And to see those people coming through and, you know, as a global culture, we do all feed on each other's influences and the work that people are doing. I think that what is essentially British about it is that very subversive, you know, punky, I guess cheekiness almost, and very dark, very dark.
Mm. But you also see that in Doctor Who.
Yeah.
That's always felt about whether it's novels or television or comic books, that there's, the storytelling is always of a high standard.
Mm.
Like, particularly in Doctor Who, you could forgive some of the effects and stuff because now that I've gone back and watched a fair amount of Doctor Who, the story's always thinking outside the box, trying different things, compelling characters, which often you don't get to see that much of in American TV, as you should.
I think this meant that I have a very low threshold for mainstream superhero comics, and I have read some very good ones, like Hawkeye was fantastic.
Mm.
Matt Fraction, just great. But I generally don't have much tolerance because it seems so straightforward and it doesn't feel like the stakes are high enough and that the plots can only play out in certain ways. And I wanted more. I wanted depth and richness, and I wanted to be surprised. And that's what I look for in the kinds of books that I read as well, is I want to be surprised. I don't want to see the ending coming. I don't want to predict it. I don't want it to be paint by numbers. It has to do something different.
Yeah, I mean, one of my earliest memories of 2008 is when they killed Johnny Alpha.
Mm.
And I was like, spoilers. And I was like, no way. He's going to come back. They're going to bring him back, right? I mean, I don't know if they ever did, but.
We did eventually. John Wagner worked out a way to do it a few years ago. So Johnny is back, but different.
He was gone for, I mean, how long?
20 years.
Yeah. You don't see that in superhero comics.
No, they're gone for like, you know, this season. And then next year there's a reboot.
Yeah. The universe gets rebooted and bam, they're back.
Meaningless.
There was just such a finality to that. That had a huge impact on me when I read it. I was like, you can do this?
I think, you know, you know what else did that very well was Robotech.
Yes.
The TV series. Hmm. That also just blew my mind because they just killed characters. I'm like, what? This is a kid's cartoon. What's going on?
Straight out of the gate. I know, totally. Brother.
Yeah.
But I love it when you see people talking about things like Game of Thrones or you know the latest Joss Whedon project where they say, you know, oh, who's going to die? Oh, they keep killing people off, and you go, well, that's kind of how the stakes are made, really. You know, it kind of has to be the ultimate sanction.
Absolutely, definitely. But I think this is something we try to do in our own work. You know, we've been writing together on Survivors Club. We really try and push it further. We try to, you know, push the horror further and push the scenarios further and make it stranger and weirder and unexpected. It's very important for us. And I think that comes back to the influence of reading 2000 AD and a whole bunch of other things as well.
Rob Williams, who's one of our current writers, gave a great piece of advice about writing for 2000 AD where he said, think of your scenario, think of your situation, whatever, and then push it as far as you think it will go, and then just keep pushing it.
Yep.
Until it goes off the edge, and then bring it back a little bit so it's legible to people, and then you've got a 2000 AD story, which I think is probably the best summation of things like Slain, Nemesis the Warlock, Zenith, you know, it's always the unexpected. It never really sinks to cliche.
Absolutely. And what's also really important, because I see a lot of high concept novels coming out these days, and also TV shows. And I'm going to stop naming my least favorite writer because Dale says I'm going to get in trouble. But but you know, it's TV shows. It's not books. But they have this high concept and they don't know what to do with it. They don't know how to land the ending. And it's so frustrating. But 2000 AD, for the most part, landed the endings.
So a big thank you to Lauren and Dale for chatting to us about their love of 2000 AD. Do pick up Lauren's books, which I've read several of them, and they're all very, very good. And yes, you can absolutely see the DNA of 2000 AD in her writing. And an outside recommendation for a 2000 AD podcast, but Survivors Club is well worth your time. So thanks again to both Lauren and Dale. We will be back in 2 weeks' time with more fantastic guests, more talk about 2000 AD. Make sure you tune in. Make sure you spread the word of the 2000 AD Thrillcast Earthlits. Splundig ver Thrig. Now, are you reading the galaxy's greatest comic? 2000 AD is in orbit every Wednesday from all good newsagents and comic book stores. 2000 AD is also available digitally. You can get PDF copies, which are DRM-free, from our website at www.2000adonline.com, or you can download the free 2000 AD app for Apple and Android devices. Now, you get that by searching for 2000 space AD in iTunes and the Google Play Store. There's also the Judge Dredd magazine, which is published in print and digital every month with more pages, more Dredd-centric stories, special features, and a bagged reprint magazine featuring forgotten 2000 AD classics. And don't forget that our graphic novels, including absolute timeless classics like Strontium Dog, Ace Trucking, Flesh, Judge Dredd, Slain, Robo Hunter, and many, many more, are also available digitally through our webshop and app. We're on social media with the latest announcements, competitions and freebies. Search on Facebook and Google Plus for 2000 AD. If you're on Instagram, we're Insta2000AD, and you can follow us on Twitter where we are at 2000AD. Remember, Earthlits, don't be a Grexnix, Splundig ver Thrig.